Cardboard, a human serviette, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM at
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Hosted by the Indigenous Collective of CITR 101.9 FM, Unseated Airwaves unveils the hidden pages of Indigenous history and contemporary existence. We are back and looking for passionate folks to contribute to the process of putting together our weekly radio show. Our community centers Indigenous joy, excellence, and current issues. Friends and allies are welcome. No experience is necessary. Come learn with us. Our Instagram is Unseated Airwaves, and that's the best way to keep up with us. If you're interested in getting involved or you have any questions, email me, indigenouscollective@citr.ca. Hello, and welcome to Unseated Airwaves. My name is Danny, and this is the show by the Indigenous Collective of CITR 101.9 FM. The Indigenous Collective has many different members who you can find across our Instagram page at Unseated Airwaves. And everybody is very busy bees and for one reason or another could not make today. So it's just me today for now. Others may join. And today's episode is talking about the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, policing in general, and this structure of oppression. My name is Danny. I am Otipemso Nehya, Métis Cree on my father's side, mixed white settler, and we are currently on the unceded, unsurrendered, occupied territory of the Musqueam Nation. The Musqueam Nation is a Hunkelmeenum-speaking nation, and their lands occupy the western side of what has been called Vancouver. Other areas that we broadcast all the way out to are the areas that are home to the Tsleil-Waututh Nation and the Squamish Nation, all unceded, unsurrendered, and occupied territories. This show is hosted by the Indigenous Collective, which is one of many different collectives here at CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine. If you've been keeping up with things lately, you've probably definitely heard about the murders committed by police in recent times. They're always murdering, because that's what they do. But in recent history, there has been seven Indigenous people murdered by the RCMP since August 29th. I'm going to play this clip from City News posted 9 days ago. And it is titled, Six Indigenous People Killed Across Canada by Police Since August 29th. So I'll play that and then we will come back.
Six Indigenous people have been killed across Canada in police-involved incidents since August 29th. That was the day 31-year-old Jack Charles Peach from Clearwater Dene Nation in Saskatchewan was hit by an RCMP vehicle while walking on the 909 Grid Road off Highway 155 near Buffalo Narrows. Just one day later, 15-year-old Haas Lightning from Samson Cree Nation in Alberta was shot by RCMP during a confrontation after police confiscated several weapons from the teen. September 3rd in Winnipeg, 39-year-old Tammy Bateman was hit by a police cruiser driving through an encampment at Fort Rouge Park. Incidents have extended beyond the prairies. On September 6th, Jason West, a 57-year-old Indigenous man, was shot during a confrontation with Windsor police in Ontario. September 8th, 31-year-old Danny Knife from Attakakoop Cree Nation in Saskatchewan was shot by Shelbrook RCMP during the response to an assault at the Cree Nation, which also resulted in non-life-threatening injuries to an officer. The same day, Stephen Iggy Didam from Elsibokdok First Nation in New Brunswick was shot by RCMP. Officers say Didam was in mental distress, had a weapon, and would not cooperate with police. Dominic Didam, Stephen Didam's uncle, is saying his death and many others in the community did not need to happen.
He was a kind person, generous. He was fun. He was funny. He was kind. He took care of a lot of people. he would do without as long as his son, his girlfriend, or other people were happy.
This is how Dominique says he left Stephen the night he was killed. Dominique says within 20 minutes, two officers were at their door after Stephen's girlfriend called 911 saying he was going to hurt himself.
The two that were there, that originally there, didn't do anything to try to help him. The only thing they did is they handcuffed him. A level-headed officer, RCMP officer, came in. You know, there's some good officer. Came in and at least put dressing on him and, you know, called the ambulance right away.
Dominique believes police officers did not need to use lethal force, saying his nephew could have been talked down with IndigiWatch, a group meant to work with police to de-escalate situations. Dominique confirms they were not on the scene. So with six separate incidents across the country, people are asking if these are truly one-off situations or if there is a larger issue with officers' response and behavior in instances where Indigenous people are present.
It's hard for us as First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people in this country to answer the question, who do we call when we need help? Because we certainly can't call police or RCMP.
Community leader in Winnipeg, Michael Redhead Champagne, says deaths of people like Peach, Lightning, Bateman West, Knife, and DDAM are examples of the broken kinship between Indigenous communities and law enforcement.
What we do see is when Indigenous-led and de-escalation-led safety practices are applied in situations where folks are heated or escalated, at least in the projects that I'm connected to, sometimes in 80 to 90% of those cases, those escalated individuals end up calming down. Why? Because they're humanized, they're respected, they're referred to an appropriate resource, and, oh yeah, they're not shot and killed when they're asking for support.
In all of the cases, independent watchdogs like the Serious Incident Response Team are investigating all the deaths. In Winnipeg, Joanne Roberts, City News.
Thank you to Joanne Roberts for that journalism and sharing these stories of six people who have been murdered by the RCMP across so-called Canada. This blurb comes from one of our members, I believe it to be the lovely Olivia. Tonight's episode will discuss the ongoing and, quote, past violence of the RCMP or other policing institutions towards Indigenous communities. These topics are difficult, uncomfortable, and Indigenous communities should not have to sit or exemplify the realities that have already been known. We know that this violence is ongoing, continues to harm Indigenous people, and there is a responsibility to exemplify their voices. There is a collective responsibility to continue decolonizing works that allow Indigenous nations to have their own existence in their own way. So, first I want to talk a little bit about how the Royal Canadian Mounted Police came to be. And before I read a blurb from Legal Aid Saskatchewan, the Gladue Rights Research Database, I want to read just some notes that I took looking at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's website, where they're talking about their history. The website only says that there were some, quote, dark chapters, but there is no mention of Indian agents and no mention of oppression of Indigenous people throughout the entire history they give. The only mention of Indigenous peoples in the history of the Northwest Mounted Police that given by the RCMP on their website is this quote, but the order in council to establish the Northwest Mounted Police wasn't signed until August 30th, 1873. This was in response to an attack on First Nations peoples in the Cypress Hills by American whiskey traders and wolf hunters. Later that year, on November 3rd, the first 150 recruits gathered at Lower Fort Garry near Winnipeg, Manitoba to start training. The next summer, the Northwest Mounted Police, now with 300 recruits, set out on the march west. Along the way, it set up posts, now known as divisions, each with smaller outposts, now known as detachments. In these posts, the Northwest Mounted Police employed First Nations, Métis, and Métis guides, scouts, and interpreters. I find this absolutely horrendous that the only time they're mentioning relations with Indigenous people on the website of the history of the RCMP is to frame it as if it was created to protect Indigenous people and to give Indigenous people careers. I find that absolutely disgusting how they frame this and the true history. And you can find a lot more about the true history on Legal Aid Saskatchewan on their Gladue Rights Research Database. So they have a whole history of the RCMP and it goes on a lot longer than this, but I want to read some of the history that they do give here. So This is from the Gladue Rights Research Database, and the original author of this is unknown and not published on their website. The Northwest Mounted Police was established in 1873 by the government of John A. MacDonald. The Cypress Hills Massacre, as well as the increasing number of conflicts on the U.S. border due to alcohol smuggling, are often cited as the main reasons that the MacDonald government passed the bill creating the new military-style police force. However, most historians agree that the primary reason for establishing the force was to control First Nations and Métis populations, as the government sought to populate the West with settlers. Under the central authority of Ottawa, the NWMP marched west in 1874. The NWMP served as an arm of colonial control for politicians and lawmakers in Ottawa. For Indigenous communities in the Northwest, it represented an additional source of repression. The newly formed paramilitary-style force was entrusted with wide-ranging powers and duties. Officers acted as justices of the peace, able to apprehend and sentence offenders, as well as impose Indian Act policies such as the pass system. Since Western Courthouse did not exist at the time on the prairies, the NWMP barracks were often used for court proceedings as well as temporary prisons. The NWMP assisted Indian agents with the ration system, as well as enforcing laws obliging Indigenous students to attend residential schools. Government policies, such as the Indian Act, subjected Indigenous families to violence, cultural dislocation, and land dispossession. The NWMP was successful in instituting a system of surveillance and curtailment, restricting Indigenous people to their reserves, regulating their land use, and criminalizing livestock theft to benefit settler farmers and ranchers. And again, that comes from the Gladue Rights Research Database by Legal Aid Saskatchewan. And that's only part of it. They have even more on their website about the true history of the RCMP. And I also recommend looking at what the RCMP says about the RCMP, because it's quite ridiculous to see what they'll do to skirt around the issue and not say what they did. So next, I want to play a clip that is from, this is from Global News, and it's Blake Desjarlais, who is a Métis MP in Alberta. I'm not sure what region, but he's for the NDP, and this is from Global News, and it's titled, No More, NDP MP Calls for Support to Indigenous Communities After 7 Killed by Police in 14 Days, and this is from the 17th. Later in the video, you'll hear from someone who I forget their position, but I really don't like how they frame the issue, and they definitely use wrong terminology by saying something Indigenous policing, which is not what this is about. But here's what Blake Desjarlais had to say.
19 days, 7 Indigenous people were killed by police. Communities are disturbed, but unfortunately, these tragedies are known all too well by Indigenous people. This is colonialism and systemic racism that continues to persist under consecutive governments. First Nations, Métis, and Inuit have the solutions to end this violence. No more Indigenous children getting a bullet instead of help. Why won't the Minister of Public Safety act to ensure accountability and justice for these families?
The Honourable Parliamentary Secretary.
Mr. Speaker, I appreciate the comments and I appreciate the passion from my colleague, and I agree that we need to do more in this country around Indigenous policing. And that's why the Liberals, including myself, put forward a motion at the INAN Committee in April saying, let's study this. The NDP has the ability to put this up
here. And in that clip, I'm not going to play the whole thing, but you can hear the loud boos and people getting quite aggravated at what he has to say, and this is the Crown Minister for Indigenous Relations, and he's definitely framing it within a neoliberal capitalist perspective. One journalist that is really on to things when it comes to Indigenous people and murders by the police and police treatment of Indigenous people is Brandy Morin. Brandy Morin is Cree, Iroquois, and French, and is a journalist for Al Jazeera, National Geographic, and The Guardian. Brandy Morin has an Instagram, B Morin Stories, that I highly recommend you follow. And I wanted to play a clip that I saw today that is by Brandy Morin, and it is Brandy Morin speaking with Natalie Lightning, who is the grandmother to Hoss Lightning, who was a 15-year-old boy who was murdered by the RCMP in Alberta on August 29th.
Beautiful kid.
He's very handsome.
There's a picture with all his siblings. Oh, right here. It was him that came over and, look, where's the keys to the lawnmower? I'm going to do the yard, you know, it was him, you know. Look, when I turn 18, I'm going to go to work for you. And I'm like, what? You know, so that you don't have to work. I'll make your truck payments. You know, honestly, at the time, I was so hurt that I didn't even want to think about it. I'm so hurt that he's gone. I'm so hurt that I'm not going to see him. I'll see him when I get there. What the hell is going on? What the hell? What's going on here? It's like, I can't comprehend how their first thought would be shoot and ask questions later. You know what I mean? It gets me mad. Like, and I get mad, and then usually it's in the evenings I get mad. I do, because I do. I smudge because I don't want my heart to be filled with anger, right? I don't want it to be filled with anger. I don't. I just go through all the good types, you know? Songs you'd send me and tell me, oh, Kokumiga, I don't want this song. Kokumiga, listen to this song. But I couldn't make him stay in. I couldn't make him stay put, you know what I mean? Because he knew he would go right back to that old home.
That absolutely heartbreaking clip comes from Brandy Morin, again, an Indigenous journalist for Al Jazeera, National Geographic, The Guardian, and more, from her Instagram, B. Morin Stories. Next, I want to talk about CIRG, which is a organization that has been under the RCMP that was created in British Columbia in recent times, and was also a part of surveilling the encampment at UBC. So I'm going to read off the open letter to abolish the RCMP Community Industry Response Group, CIRG. So I'll read the entire thing, and you can find this open letter online just by searching C-IRG open letter. This letter is a collective response to the massive number of incidents, violence, assault, unlawful conduct, and racism of the CIRG police unit in Canada. It is a call for the immediate abolition of this force. It is a call that highlights the establishment of this unit specifically to pacify Indigenous assertions of jurisdiction against industrial resource operations in the province of BC. This force has been instrumental in the ongoing criminalization of Indigenous rights. We call on the province of BC, the Ministry of Public Safety, and the Solicitor General, the Federal Ministry of Public Safety and PMO, and RCMP E Division to immediately disband the CIRG. The Community Industry Response Group, CIRG, was formed by the RCMP in 2017 in response to anticipated Indigenous resistance to industrial resource operation in the province of British Columbia, specifically the Coastal GasLink and Trans Mountain Pipeline. CIRG's operations have since expanded past the energy industry to forestry and hydro operations. Over the years, activists have filed hundreds of individual complaints and several collective complaints to the Civilian Review and Complaints Commission, CRCC. In addition, journalists at Ferry Creek and on Wet'suwet'en territories have brought lawsuits against CIRG and land defenders at Gidim 10 have brought civil claims and sought a stay of proceedings for charter violations. Activists at Ferry Creek challenged an injunction on the grounds for that CERG activity brings the administration of justice into disrepute and launched a civil class action alleging systemic charter violations. Suquamish, Wet'suwet'en, and Treaty 8 land defenders also filed the Urgent Action Early Warning request from the United Nations in response to CERG incursions on their land for protecting contested extraction. Gitxsan hereditary leaders have spoken out about the unnecessary militarization and criminalization displayed by CERG. Some of the hereditary chiefs have called for CERG to be prohibited from their lands for the safety of all. Even given the serious nature of allegations against CERG, we call on Canada, BC, and the RCMP E Division Command to suspend all CERG duties and deployment. The suspension and disbandment would allow BC, with its stated commitments to the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People Act, DRIPA, and the Declaration Act Action Plan, which aims to protect Indigenous self-determination and inherent title and rights. We also call on the federal government to intervene, given its own commitments to UNDRIP and pending legislation, as well as to its lawful obligations to protect Section 35 Aboriginal constitutional rights. CERG operates through a divisional command structure. The divisional command structure is usually touted as a temporary emergency measure to handle particular incidents, such as the Vancouver Olympics or a hostage situation. The logic of the Gold, Silver, Bronze GSB system is that it prescribes a chain of command structure to coordinate policing as integrated response. As far as the public record shows, using the divisional command structure as a permanent policing structure, it's unprecedented in Canada. Potential disruption to critical infrastructure construction that can take place over many years, even decades, are being treated as emergency critical incidents. This emergency command structure has become a permanent structure for policing Indigenous peoples and supporters in BC. CERG operation and expansion thus also goes against the Police Act Reform Committee hearings, where the provincial legislative report stated that recognizing the need for Indigenous self-determination, the committee recommends Indigenous communities have direct input into the structure and governance of police services. Internal RCMP reviews of the CERG cannot address these fundamental concerns. On March 8, the CRCC, the oversight body of the RCMP, announced that it is launching a systemic review into investigating the Community Industry Response Group, CERG, pursuant to Section 4534 of the RCMP Act. See your concerns with this review here. We submit, however, that there is no set of reforms that would make it acceptable for Canada to have a paramilitary force designed specifically to manage the assertion of inherent and constitutionally protected Indigenous rights in the face of unwanted development. The CERG should not exist, and it needs to be disbanded entirely. We demand that deployment of CERG in BC be immediately suspended pending full and fair resolution, review, determination, and remediation of each and all of the hundreds of complaints to CRCC alleging CERG use of force to unlawfully arrest, detain, and assault people. These people were exercising protected rights to protest non-consensual corporate extraction and pipeline construction activities on the basis that these corporate activities cause irremediable damage to Indigenous environmental and community rights. The extent of the human rights abuses and violation of Indigenous inherent rights committed by the CERG has not yet fully come to light. Therefore, any investigation must look thoroughly at CERG's action beyond known complaints. Instead, the province and RCMP are moving in the opposite of justice by continuing to support and expand the CERG. The Tyee recently revealed that the unit received an additional $36 million in funding. Why is the police force receiving more funds when the United Nations has stated in a third rebuke that the government of Canada and BC have escalated their use of force, surveillance, and criminalization of land defenders to intimidate, remove, and forcibly evict Suquamish and Wet'suwet'en nations from their traditional lands? A recent report by the UN Special Rapporteurs also command that the criminalization of Indigenous land defenders by the CERG. Also condemned the criminalization of Indigenous land defenders by the CERG. Failure by the Ministry of Public Safety and Solicitor General to call for a halt to CERG deployment in BC pending determination of the complaints is a tactic admission that the CRCC process is capable of recording complaints but not remedying their damage. So next, I'm going to take a break and play a song. I'm going to play the song Woodcarver by the Hallucination back from when they went by a tribe called Red. And this song is about the murder of John T. Williams in Seattle.
Hey! 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 Put the knife down! Put the knife down! Put the knife down!
The family of a woodcarver shot to death by a Seattle police officer says that an autopsy shows he was not facing the officer. Officer Ian Burke shot and killed John T. Williams in August. Williams' family tells our newspaper partner, the Seattle Times, he suffered 4 gunshot wounds on the right side of his body. The Seattle Police Department's Firearms Review Board completed a confidential inquiry Monday to determine if that shooting was justified, and that review has now been passed on to the police CCS.
We're waiting to hear more about what led to a deadly shooting in the busy part of downtown Seattle tonight. We know a man was shot and killed near the intersection of Bourne Avenue and Howard Street. We also know it was a Seattle police officer who pulled the trigger. John Hopperstead picks it up from there.
Seattle police are investigating whether the shooting of woodcarver John T. Williams was justified. But in the minds of those who led a memorial tonight at the place he died, it's clear what happened.
The Seattle police officer who shot and killed Native American woodcarver John T. Williams in August has turned in his gun and badge. Police sources tell Q13 Fox News the department's firearms review board reached a preliminary finding that Officer Ian Burke was not justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
A woman crossing the street is visibly shaken by the shot. After the woman walks out of frame, we hear a female voice say something to the officer. It's garbled. It sounds like she's asking, "What did you do that for?" Officer Burke responds,
"Man, he had a knife and he wouldn't drop it."
Just kind of didn't seem right, you know. I understand that he got shot 4 times, and it just, to me, it seemed a little excessive.
One witness we spoke with said he never saw a knife, but the victim was not acting in a threatening way.
He was murdered for no reason. This man was disabled. He was deaf in one ear, and he never harmed a soul.
But Williams' supporters say the video proves that they believe that it was an unprovoked shooting of a harmless woodcarver.
I think that this was a murder.
Heaven just justice done for John T. Williams.
He had problems, but you know what? There was no reason to take a gun off and kill that man that way.
Put the knife down! Put the knife down!
his fellow officers, he was afraid and never says Williams was threatening anyone.
Strong community reaction tonight from those who argue all along that John T. Williams should have never been killed.
If you spent 5 minutes with this man, you would have never gotten any information that he was violent or could hurt you in any way.
What do you love, and what do you love about it? My name is Ewan, and with I Love You Hour, I want to know. Come join me bi-weekly Tuesdays at 6 p.m. to discuss music and the stories we connect to it, either in person, on the phone, or through messages at I Love You Hour on Instagram. That's I-L-U-V-U Hour on Instagram, or through email at iluvhour@gmail.com. If you love sharing music and telling stories, listen to I Love You Hour bi-weekly at CITR 101.9. And remember, I love you.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Hello and welcome to Unseated Airwaves. We are back after that short break, and the tracks that you just heard were, one was Woodcarver by The Hallucination, and then the second one was Martyr by Smother, who is a local Indigenous hardcore band that we play on here sometimes. My name is Danny, the Indigenous Collective Lead. I use she, her pronouns, and yeah, I'm joined with a new member.
Hello, my name's Cooper. I use he, him pronouns. I'm the new member.
Yeah, at the beginning I already did a full introduction, but if there's anything else you want to say, go ahead. Yeah, we usually do a full one at the beginning, but we can also come back on, just be like, yo, what's up?
Okay. I'm Red River Métis from Winnipeg, and I just moved here. I'm first year, excited to begin.
Yippee. Well, this is like a pretty sad episode to join in on, but very, very important. Welcome, Cooper. So we'll be reading another article from Brandy Morin, and I didn't even realize this was another article by Brandy Morin until I opened up the article and looked, because Brandy Morin seems to be like holding so much like on her shoulders when it comes to this topic of RCMP relations with Indigenous people. And thank you so much, Brandy Morin, for everything you have done for all of this, basically fueling our episode today. So today is on RCMP and Indigeneity and honoring the victims. So this article that we'll be reading is on Al Jazeera, again by Brandy Morin, and it is The Indigenous People Killed by Canada's Police. This is from March of 2021, so it's outdated but still relevant. So it's the stories of Indigenous people who died in police encounters in Canada and the loved ones they left behind. And there's a lot of illustrations and pictures throughout this article, and unfortunately we can't share those with you through the air. So I'll start off here. Despite making up just 5% of Canada's population, 30% of the country's prisoners are Indigenous. Across the prairie provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, regions that have higher populations of Indigenous people, that number rises to 54%. According to a 2017 CTV News analysis, an Indigenous person in Canada is 10 times more likely to be shot and killed by a police officer than a white person. Between 2017 and 2020, 25 Indigenous people were known to be shot and killed by the RCMP, Canada's Federal and National Police Service.
The latest case came on February 27th when Julian Jones, a 28-year-old... Clalkiot man was shot and killed by British Columbia after Tofino police responded to a call for help from the
I don't know how it's pronounced, but it's spelled O-P-I-T-S-A-H-T.
Reserve, which is accessible only by boat. It was the second police killing of Talkiot First Nation a Talkiot First Nations member in less than a year following the death of Chantel Moore in June 2020. Here are stories of some of the Indigenous men and women who have been killed in encounters with Canadian police.
In the early hours of the morning on June 4, 2020, police in the New Brunswick city of Edmundston reportedly responded to a call from Chantel Moore's boyfriend requesting a wellness check. Her boyfriend, who lived more than 1,000 kilometers away in Toronto, reportedly believed that Chantel was being harassed. The 26-year-old Clalkiot First Nation member from British Columbia had recently moved to New Brunswick to be closer to her 6-year-old daughter, who lived with Chantel's mother. Part of this article is covered with an ad that I can't get rid of, so I guess we'll have to... That is so strange. So we have to skip two or three sentences that are giving details on the murder of Chantel Moore. There is definitely an issue with this article because so much of it is covered with ads. So give me one second while I copy and paste some of the lines so that we can give you the best of this article that we can. And that's really, honestly, really upsetting and says a lot about capitalism that there is literally an ad covering this article about the murders of Indigenous people. So let's get back to where we started in this and, yeah.
According to the police, Chantel had walked out of her apartment onto the balcony with a knife and had threatened the officer who then shot her. I don't understand how someone dies during a wellness check, Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller said at a news conference following Chantel's death. After Chantel's body was returned to British Columbia, her maternal grandmother, Grace Frank, and her mother, Martha Martin, went to view it. Her face was bruised, her right eye sunk in, she had 7 gunshot wounds on her body, and her left leg wasn't attached below the kneecap, Grace recalled tearfully. Adding the police had not offered any explanation for the condition of her body. The family wanted to protect Chantel's daughter, Gracie, named after her great-grandmother, from learning how her mother died, but the 6-year-old accidentally saw a news report about it on TV. Her great-grandmother says it left her devastated. Gracie is so sad, she said. I want to get angel wings. I want to go see my mom. And she's scared and cries, I don't want to be shot like that. I don't want to die like that.
Grace, that's just heartbreaking. I hope that this episode, anyone who's listening, really touches you as this article does and shares some of the reality faced, and that it's not just a name and a picture. It is stories like these. Grace remembered how Chantel would go out of her way to give her daughter the best Christmases and birthdays she could, adding Chantel was such a good mommy. She was the kindest, most caring, loving, supportive, bubbly person. She never had hate for anyone. People loved her. When asked about the condition of Chantel's body, Michelle Poitras, community director for the city of Edmundston, said no comments can be made since the file is with the provincial prosecutor's office. The name of the officer who shot Chantel has not been released, but eight investigators with Quebec's independent police watchdog group, New Brunswick does not have its own, have completed an investigation into her death. The Bureau des Enquêtes Indépendantes forwarded its response to the New Brunswick Police Prosecution Service and to the case coroner in December. The prosecution's office has said that it will review the report and determine whether to charge the officer. The Clalquiot First Nation is demanding that the officer be charged with murder and that body cameras be mandatory for all police officers working with the public. It has also requested a full national inquiry into the root causes of police brutality against Indigenous people. Quote, this killing was completely senseless, quote, the nation said in a press release. Quote, at the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls inquiry, RCMP Commissioner Brenda Lucky committed to do better by First Nations. She said, I'm sorry that for too many of you, the RCMP was not the police service that it needed to be during this terrible time in your life. It is very clear to me that the RCMP could have done better, and I promise to you that we will do better. We are still waiting for better, and Chantel certainly deserved better. In mid-November, less than 6 months after Chantel's death, her 23-year-old brother, Mike Martin, took his own life while being held in a correctional center in British Columbia. I'm trying to be okay, but I'm sad, wrote Grace in a social media post in December. I'm hurting, I'm angry, I'm full of rage, I'm full of disgust. I think about my granddaughter and my grandson. They should both be alive. It's so unfair that they're gone, and I will not give up until justice is served. My heart is aching.
The Starlight Tours, Neil Stonechild, 17, killed November 1990. On the golden wheat-covered prairies of Saskatchewan. Sorry, there's an ad covering this again. On the golden wheat-covered prairies of Saskatchewan, a deadly phenomenon known as the Starlight Tours has been threatening Indigenous people for decades. No one here is certain where or when the term originated, but Indigenous residents know exactly what it stands for. Police taking Indigenous people often said to have been picked up well intoxicated and dropping them off at the edge of the city of Saskatoon at night, where temperatures regularly drop to as low as minus 28 Celsius, negative 20 Fahrenheit during winter. In November 1990, a 17-year-old, do you know how to pronounce that? Sorry.
Salto
First Nations boy was found frozen to death in a field of the outskirts of Saskatoon. Neil Stonechild was faced down in the snow wearing one shoe, and he had cut marks on his face and arms. He was found by construction workers on November 29th, 5 days after he was last seen. An autopsy indicated that he had died of hypothermia, but his devastated family suspected foul play. On the golden wheat-covered prairies of Saskatchewan, a deadly phenomenon... Oh, sorry, I'm repeating it because I think the article... It was covered by the ad again, and then
quite terrible. There's just so many ads covering so much of this article, and it's pretty obscene. So we'll get right back to you with the rest of this in one moment.
A police investigation after his death was closed after just 3 days. Former Saskatoon Police Sergeant Keith Jarvis, who conducted the investigation, explained in his report, it is felt that unless something concrete but... Sorry. It is felt that unless something concrete by the way of evidence is... By the way of evidence to the contrary is obtained, the deceased died from exposure and froze to death. At the time of his death, Neil was living between a group home accommodation that houses multiple children and young people in the foster care system in the west end of Saskatoon and his mother's house. According to his older brother, Dean Lidgren, who is now 54, Neil was a good kid who dabbled in petty crime but was not involved in violent crime or gangs. The night Neil died, he was wearing his brother's high school letterman jacket. It was, Dean remembered, one of his most prized possessions. Quote, for a long time, he kept asking me, bro, can I have your jacket? And Dean, quote, and Dean, who finally relented and gave it to his, sorry, and Dean, who finally relented and gave it to his Ted?
Is, get cut off.
Sorry.
He gave it to his brother.
Oh, sorry, I see. And gave it to his brother, who wore it proudly around Saskatchewan.
Neil was an athlete who excelled at wrestling, Dean recalled. The two brothers had a strong bond, and even though they had only known each other for 2.5 years when Neil died, Dean had been taken from his family as part of the 60 Scoop, a practice enacted by provincial and federal Canadian governments from the 1960s to the 1980s, in which Indigenous children were taken from their families and adopted by white families across Canada and the United States. After finishing high school, Dean traveled from his adoptive home in Minnesota to in the U.S. to find his biological family in Saskatoon. He immediately bonded with his younger brother, and it was said that the week before he died, the two brothers had planned to travel to the province of Ontario to pick up a car Dean had bought and drive it back to Saskatoon together. He wanted to come so bad, Dean said of his brother, but in the end, Dean went alone. I kick myself every time I talk about this, he said. Driving back to Saskatoon, Dean hit black ice and destroyed his new car. He borrowed a stranger's phone. Sorry, we have had an issue here. Sorry, we are having a big issue here with the copy and pasting. I just accidentally copied and pasted a whole page from Al Jazeera. But, he borrowed a stranger's phone to call home. The U.S. Army veteran breaks down in tears as he describes what happened next. I called my cousin Andrea. I was frantic about my car, but she asked me, are you sitting down, Dean? Your brother was killed. His world momentarily stopped. Then the words hit him hard. He took a bus back to Saskatoon. Dean remembers hearing that Neil was with his 16-year-old friend, Jason Roy, the night he went missing. But for 10 years, Jason did not talk about what happened that night. He later explained in a phone call from his home in Saskatoon that he had been traumatized and scared of potential repercussions for speaking out. Then on January 19, 2000, Lloyd Dustyhorn, a 53-year-old First Nations man, was found frozen to death in Saskatoon. The day before, he had been taken into custody by police for public intoxication. In May 2001, following an inquest, a jury decided that his death had been caused by hypothermia. Later that night, Daryl Knight, a Cree man from Saskatoon, told police that two officers had dropped him off several miles outside of Saskatoon in freezing temperatures. Daryl had been having a drunken argument with his uncle and said the officers picked him up outside his uncle's apartment before dawn on January 28th. He was wearing only a t-shirt and running shoes when they left him in a remote rural area outside the city. He managed to walk several miles to a power station where a watchman let him call a taxi.
The next day, the shirtless body of Rodney... I'm also not sure how to pronounce his last name, but it's spelled N-A-I-S-T-U-S. A 25-year-old Indigenous man was found near where Daryl said the police officers had dropped him off. A few days later, on February 3rd, 2000, the body of another Indigenous man, 30-year-old Lawrence Kim Wegner, who had been last seen 3 days later, 3 days earlier, was found only wearing a t-shirt, socks, and jeans. Both men appeared to be frozen to death, possibly dying within hours of being released from police custody, according to police investigations and police inquests. These cases prompted the province of Saskatchewan to hold an inquiry into the alleged Starlight Tours to re-examine Neil's death. Jason testified to the inquiry, telling it about the last time he had seen his friend alive on that bitterly cold November night in 1990. He and Neil had been walking in the city's West End after drinking at an apartment building in the area, he said. The two briefly separated, Jason recalled, and the next time he saw Neil was in the back seat of a police cruiser, with a bloodied face, screaming for help and telling Jason, quote, "They're going to kill me." The inquiry found that Neil was in the custody of police constables Larry Hartwig and Bradley Senger, and that the injuries and marks to his body were likely caused by handcuffs. The officers denied having been in contact with Neil the night he died, but the evidence contradicted their claim, and the two were dismissed from duty in November 2004. A court upheld the findings of the inquiry when the two police officers appealed against it.
Despite this, no Saskatoon police officer has been tried for Neil's death or those of any other Indigenous people who froze to death. Today, Dean says he harbors hatred for the officers he believed took the life of his brother. "I will never forgive Hartwig and Senger, never," he said angrily. When George Floyd was killed by U.S. police in Minneapolis, Dean said it stirred up memories. "I understand exactly what the family is going through," he said. "When I saw the cops killing George Floyd on the video, I had instant rage. Quote, down here it's not safe for the blacks, and up in Canada it's bad for the natives."
Back in Saskatoon, Jason is working to overcome the trauma of the last time he saw his friend. He wants the police to implement the recommendations of the inquiry into his friend's death, which included cultural and sensitivity training to equip police to deal with the high-stress situations involving Indigenous people who are often dealing with trauma as a result of generations of abuse, neglect, and discrimination. Quote, "The police have only found different ways to abuse our people. My people are still being abused," quote, he says, "but I am not scared of them. There is no way I was going to let them win." His life was only worth 20 minutes of their time.
And I think we'll conclude the reading of the article there. There's a lot more to read and more cases and stories. It goes on for over 20 more pages in how it's been copied and pasted into our document. So please check this article out on Al Jazeera by Brandy Morin. And again, it's called "The Indigenous People Killed by Canada's Police." I think this is a really good example of how crime is a construct. Like any random individual, if they go out and do this to someone, take them out to the outskirts of town, leave them there to die, they will go to jail. But cops can do it over and over and over and over again, and it's unlikely they'll ever even be named, let alone have anything done, and let alone maybe the maximum will be being dismissed from their career, and many won't even be named. And I think that's just a really good example of how crime is, in fact, a social construct. And it's just all really, really upsetting, and I wish people knew more about what's going on here and how there is no repairing this. Police, in how they were created, it is a shared trauma between Indigenous and Black communities in the way that they were literally police forces in America were created as, quote, slave catchers. And then the Northwest Mounted Police in Canada were created to deal with First Nations and Métis people who were resisting the colonial settlement of Canada. But you won't find that on the RCMP's website where they talk about their history. I want to play, as we finish off this, I want to play a song that is actually in our promo, and it's by The Hallucination and Saul Williams, and it's called The Virus. We might not get through the whole thing because the episode will be ending, but this is about the shared traumas of colonialism.
Many shapes, the bear, the elk, the antelope, the elephant, the deer, the mineral, the iron, the copper, the colton, the rubber, the coffee, the cotton, the sugar, the people. We are not a conquered people.